Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Wednesday, December 1st, 2021. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the red and white bullseye or the link in the upper left-hand corner that says Start Here, it'll take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. That book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? That specific chapter of the book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 17 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to help me turn any negative emotional experience into part of the infallible guidance system that each one of us has been given. You can also download the worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Download it, copy it off, and use it as often as you'd like. You can also download a host of audio files of shows just like this one where people have been stepped through that worksheet process and or given testimonials about how the active use of that tool has improved the quality of their lives. And you can go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness and get access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We hope people do that soon and often because it leads to comments and questions or testimonials. And if you have any of those to offer, give us a call at 563-999-3581. And call that number and press 1. It'll let me know you have a comment or a question. We're doing the Course in Miracles workbook lessons this year. This is the 335th day of the year. Today's lesson simply reads, I choose to see my brother's sinlessness. The commentary reads, forgiveness is a choice. I never see my brother or sister as he or she is, for that is far beyond the potential of perception. What I see in him is merely what I wish to see, because it stands for what I want to be in truth, in the truth. It is to this alone that I respond, however much I seem to be impelled by outside happenings. I choose to see what I would look upon, and this then I see, and only this. My brother and sister's sinlessness shows me that I would look upon my own. And I will see that, having chosen to behold my fellow travelers in this holy light. What could restore your memory to me except to see my brother and sister's sinlessness? Their holiness reminds me that they were created as one with me and like myself. In them I find myself, and in your offspring I find the memory of you as well. So that's lesson 335 in Pam Grout's Course in Miracles experiment. 335 is titled Rolling in Ecstasy. She quotes Emily Brontë as saying, "Every leaf speaks bliss to me, fluttering from the autumn tree." Pam writes, "One afternoon when my daughter Taz was 4, she was playing, quote, mom, close quotes, in the backyard with her friend, Ashley. Ashley had taken her turn being mom and had dutifully washed the pretend dishes, hung up the pretend laundry, and ordered her pretend daughter, my daughter Taz, to pick up her toys. When Taz's turn came, she said, okay, now I'm the mom. I'm going to go meditate. It was one of the proudest moments of my life. My daughter believed that's what moms do first. I don't remember her friend's response, but I do know this. The most important thing I could ever do is get in tune with the divine buzz, the dude, the Holy Spirit, all of creation, God, light, love, whatever you want to call it. To get in tune with that and to know, as Lesson 335 promises, this moment is all there is. I can read all the books, follow all the steps, write affirmations to the moon and back. And yet, until I begin to feel the invisible, yet palpable buzz of right now, I will spend my life searching. I'll be searching for what is right here in this moment. So that's our Course in Miracles workbook lesson and the Course in Miracles experiment commentary, and as usual, we've got time to talk. 563-999-3581. Call that number and press 1 and let us know how we can be a support to you today. We had our Tuesday support group last night, and somebody did a worksheet. And the discussion and the worksheet and discussion after the worksheet took up the entire 2.5 hours. So that was a little bit different for a support group process. I was busy doing some of my own work this morning on emotions like feeling lost and vulnerable and feelings of grief. And we have the tools to help you if you want to deal with some of those energies, emotions, thoughts, etc., and get access to how they might be good information for you, how they might help you choose a course in your life that is more productive, moving into allowance and acceptance and surrender as opposed to running from your emotions, as so many of us are conditioned to do in this world, in this culture. And the reality management worksheet is one of the most, if not the most, effective, efficient, powerful, and because it's made available absolutely free on the internet, accessible tools I've ever encountered. I like to tell people that after 47 years of doing therapy and taking trainings in, it's 5 different states for various jobs I've held over the years and for the ongoing postdoctoral education to keep the licensure current, etc. This is the most, let's call it, available and accessible set of tools I've ever encountered. Transferable, generalizable. I talk sometimes about how occasionally somebody comes up with a wonderful new technique, whether it's the EMDR or the brain spotting, I remember there was a rapid transformation therapy as a kind of a different, kind of a much more flexible type of hypnosis. And it was amazing what the creator of this technique could help people do in short order. And lots and lots of different times I tried it with people. I took the training in it. I worked with other people who'd taken the training. And I don't know anybody who got anywhere near the results that the creator of that technique did. And that's one of the consistent patterns I would find with these therapy techniques is they work wonders in the hands of a creative genius and somebody who resonates very deeply with the work and who gets it at a powerful level. And yet, for the average person, it's very, very, what we call it, ordinary results. Not too much different than they get with regular talk therapy. So if you end up being, you know, a charismatic or creative genius, you can get powerful results with those techniques. But other than that, it's pretty much there. One is like the other. And this one thing that I've run across, the Reality Management Worksheet and its corollary tools available at yagain.org, is the exception to that rule. This is the kind of thing where time and again, I've worked with people who never did one before, and all I'm doing is reading the worksheet process. Or if it happens to come up near the end of a session and I don't have much time to talk about it, I just give them the worksheet and say, here, listen to an audio file or two and give it a try, and we'll talk more about it in the next session. And they come back in the next session and they've had a powerful experience. And of course, like with most powerful tools, the more I practice it, the greater facility I get with it, the better my results. And yet, it doesn't take the doctorate in clinical psychology, it doesn't take the creative genius, it doesn't take years and years of training to be able to begin getting good results with these tools. So, if any of that's of interest to you, let us know how we can support you, either in learning more about these tools or in actually applying them in your life. As I said, today I was doing work on emotions of grief and an emotion of feeling lost and vulnerable. And highly beneficial. Just continuing to map out what is my mind telling me about how or why I'm feeling what I'm feeling, and what is my mind telling me needs to happen in order for me to get relief or peace or calm or the sense of safety. And once I've mapped that out in the first three steps of the worksheet process, and then I decide to be willing to cancel it, and then turn my focus inward, turn my focus to an insight, an intuition, a higher level of awareness or consciousness that's accessed inside myself, that's part of my awareness, part of my connection to Source. And once I'm willing to do that and stay open to whatever bubbles up, things start to change. It continues to benefit me, sometimes amaze me, how it bypasses the conscious and the logical mind. And it even though it defies the conscious logical mind, it offers benefits. It offers new ways to look at old situations. It offers a shift in my energy. One of the things I was doing this morning was doing that kind of work on a dream I had, and I had this long involved dream, and I had this set of themes that came up in the dream, so I decided to do some energy work and worksheet process on that, and it led to awareness that there's grief in there. It led to awareness that there's a sense of loss and loneliness and lack of safety in me, in my internal processing, that I wasn't aware of. And it went back to, you know, a really early age, single digits, age 4 or 5, and things I had downloaded in my life from back then that essentially, like most of the, if not all of the negative thoughts and negative energies I experience, was based in a false perception. It was based in something I'd been conditioned to believe that just isn't the way things work. It's not the truth of life. And in this work, over and over again, we're led to observe every time I have a negative thought about myself or somebody else, or a negative emotion active in my mind, my energy system, my body, I can instantly know 3 things. The first one is, it's a lie or based in a falsehood. The next thing is, it's an old tape playing. The thoughts and emotions that I'm dealing with right now have nothing to do with the current situation. It's me living in the past, to quote Jethro Tull song lyrics. And if I act from that space, I will only, always and forever, make my current life situation worse, not better. So I have the choice. You know, I can act from it. I can believe that my thoughts are telling me the truth about the present moment experience. Or I can tap into the great observations from the deep spiritual teachings from thousands of years and recognize that if I'm in pain, I'm in error. That if my thought process is leading me to create pictures of the world where my essence is threatened, that I'm not perceiving accurately, that I'm engaging the process of perception, which is highly active and internal and unique to me. One of the lines from a previous worksheet that Dr. Michael Rice had when I first started this work about 17 or 18 years ago, one of those lines said, the truth is, my reality is strictly internal, it's unique to me, and it's created out of my own thoughts. And that's an observation that each and every one of us can make. That's an observation that our science keeps validating and verifying at different levels and getting more and more specific about. So I can wake up to that, and I can combine that with the observation that if I'm in pain, my thinking is in error. Of Course in Miracles, in the very beginning of the introduction, it says, this course can be summed up very simply in this way. Nothing real can be threatened, and nothing unreal exists. Herein lies the peace of the Creator. Nothing real can be threatened. Nothing unreal exists. So when I'm feeling threatened, what I know from these ancient teachings is I am not perceiving accurately. Short of an actual physical threat to my physical survival, if I am having an experience where I feel I'm being verbally or emotionally attacked, or my work is being attacked, and if I feel like I need to defend my work or defend how I'm right here and the other person's wrong. And what we know from the ancient teachings is when that happens, it's only happening because my thoughts are off the mark. And it's my errant thoughts, my distortion of perception, that are creating the pictures my mind is showing me. And if I want peace, if I want to see more accurately the truth of what is, I need to find a way to restore the essence of that awareness of my true nature as love to my conscious logical mind. I need to step into a process that will help me see the errors in my thought. And these tools are available to do just that. And everything else I do, every thinking, every acting, every speaking I do before I restore that calm to my mind is launching myself off on the wild goose chase. It's trying to pursue something that I already possess and I can't go anywhere or do anything to acquire that which I already possess. The knowledge of that, the ability to wake up to that truth, and the tools that are available at whyagain.org set me up for success if I'm willing to engage the process. If I'm not, if I want to fight for my negative emotion, if I want to argue about how I'm right and the world or the person in front of me or the life situation is wrong, then I continue to stay stuck. I continue to ignore the truth that is true always, that is, I and my Father are one, as the Way of Mastery would say, or I remain as the Creator created me to be, as the Way of Mastery would say. Principles of miracles in the Course in Miracles say there is no order of difficulty among miracles. One is not harder or bigger than another. They are all the same. All expressions of love, all of the extensions of the creative energy into form are as full as they can possibly be in each moment. Miracles as such do not matter. The only thing that matters is the source of miracles, which is far beyond any human evaluation. That's the energy of creation, the energy of love, light, God, it's, you know, all that is, whatever. That's what matters, not how it unfolds, but its essence is what matters. It goes on to say, miracles occur naturally as expressions of love. The real miracle is that love is the love that inspires the miracles. In this sense, everything that comes from love is a miracle. All miracles mean life, and the Creator is the giver of life. The voice for creation will direct you very specifically, and you will be told all that you need to know if you learn to listen to that still small voice. Interestingly enough to me, the Reality Management Worksheet gives me a chance to practice listening to that still small voice in each worksheet process. It gives me the opportunity to cancel everything my conscious logical mind is telling me and everything that I want to say to defend my teachings or my belief system or my actions, and to argue against how my thoughts, teachings, actions, or beliefs are better than somebody else's. every worksheet gives me the opportunity to cancel all of that and ask to be shown something else. When I do that, I often say, I said it again in the group last night, when I step into that practice of that brief meditation and I'm asking to be shown the hidden part of my mind, I'm giving myself yet one more chance at practicing listening for the still small voice, listening to the voice for miracles, listening to the voice of the Creator, listening for the, what some call the Great Comforter, the Holy Spirit, the voice within. And it's a practice that we've gotten out of, habit of doing, and we can practice and strengthen that skill and get better at it. Do we choose to do that? That's the question. Do I choose to listen, to practice listening to the voice for sanity, the voice for creation, the voice for love, the voice for connectedness, the voice for compassion? I love the way Guy Finley says this over and over again. He says, call it whatever you want. The essence of life, the wisdom of creation, the one mind, God, light, love, it doesn't matter what you call it. It's not sitting somewhere in some other location outside of you with an ego that needs to be appeased. It just extends its energy. It just extends creation in every moment. So call it what you will and give yourself an opportunity to slow down and tune into it. And the more you do, the easier it gets and the better you get at doing it. It's like any other skill. It's a skill that can be practiced. So many of us are working from the position of the training of our culture, which ends up hoping against hope to constantly keep us distracted so that we will participate in the drama and trauma of the world. What happens when we continue to participate in the drama and trauma of the world? We get stressed. We get upset. We get sad. We get angry. We get hurt. We get overwhelmed. And then we get looking for something to take us out of it. And that's when the drama and trauma of the world says, oh, we've got the answer. Here's the car you need. Here's the drug you need. Here's the fancy new home you need. Here's the game you need to be playing. It's an endless parade of distractions. And those distractions don't hold any answers. They promise answers, but they don't hold any answers. It reminds me of the story Guy Finley told of the World War II plane that went down in the atolls in the islands. And everybody survived, but, you know, the plane was wrecked and the radio was ruined so that only the receiver worked and they couldn't transmit out. And so the captain said, well, you know, I know they're going to be looking for us. I know they're going to transmit the coordinates for where we need to go and when to get rescued. So we can't go out in the daylight, so we're hiding down here in this cave. But at night, I want you, Private, to go up to this mountaintop and just sit there and tune the radio and listen to the frequency, and they're going to broadcast the details of where we need to go to get rescued. So that's your job. Just go up there and sit and tune into this radio. And so he went first night, came back, and the captain said, so what'd you hear? And he said, oh, nothing. Second night, well, what'd you learn? Oh, nothing. Third night, same thing. And the captain thought, there's something wrong here. So for the fourth night, and the private goes up there, the captain follows after him, and he just hides and listens to what's going on. And what he hears is the private's up there just surfing the radio dial. And he's listening to programs in all these various languages, French, German, Czechoslovakian, Russian. And the captain bursts out of the hiding and says, "What are you doing, man? I've seen your personnel file. I know you don't speak any of those languages. Why are you just surfing the dial instead of staying on the frequency I told you to listen to how we can get rescued?" And the private said, "Well, Captain, I got lonely. I didn't want to be up here all by myself." That's the story of our lives. We don't want to sit quietly with ourselves or sit quietly with the still small voice. We want to buy into the distractions. And we do. And at some immediate level of distraction or comfort or relief, but at a very high price long term. We stay stuck. We don't get connected to that which can save us, rescue us, teach us about ourselves is another way of talking about it. That's what we need to do. Each and every one of us needs to learn more about our true nature. The more we learn about our true nature, the better our lives get. The less we need to escape from some perception which is a distortion of our true nature, which generates the negative thoughts and emotions that we spend our times looking for distractions from. So we are blessed because we have access to tools that can help us cancel everything we think we want, make a little mental map of what are we doing with our conscious logical thought to create the upset that we then try desperately to get rid of. And then in each worksheet process, get access to this practice session where I cancel my need to be right, I cancel my need for anyone or anything else to change, including myself. I put my conscious logical mind on the shelf, and I ask to be shown. And in the asking and in the calm, quiet period after, I practice listening for the still, small voice. I practice being open to insight, intuition, connection to a higher level of wisdom. That's the core of this work. That's the unspeakable unspeakable, not because it's horrible, but because there just aren't any words to describe the power of a process like this. Its power is not outstripped by anything. Its simplicity is only outstripped by its power. So our call in number is 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, we can have a conversation. How is it striking you? How do you, or what comments or questions do you have about anything from the past 10 years or Friday's show where we talked about the invitation was to take everyone and everything off of a pedestal? So, Susan, welcome. Hopefully your microphone will be on. Hello.
Hi, are you there?
Yes.
Hi, can you hear all right? Hi.
Yep.
I listened to almost all of Friday's thing about the not making an idol out of anyone or putting someone on a pedestal, and it's been mind-blowingly life-changing to think about things that way, because I think it's a global exercise for everything we do, and I haven't finished it, so I'm not going to say much about it, but it was really, really good. I have a question, though, that's probably all questions that I ask are going to end up being related to that. But we just saw our grandson Jacob off in his car driving all the way from here to Florida, which is about a 14-hour trip. And he is so much better, but he is heavily medicated. And I was talking to you about that yesterday and about how the Lyle Murphy talk may be useful at some point. He's been diagnosed as bipolar and mildly autistic. He's very disturbed about the bipolar diagnosis and keeps asking me, do I think he is? Do I think he is? And I say, I can't tell. And I wouldn't pay any attention to that right now. Just be as well as you can. Watch your moods. See what happens there. But one thing I did hear or read the other day is that a person becomes bipolar at the point of when something happened to them that was very, very traumatic. And so it might be age 14 or something. Something terrible happens and they become bipolar. I wondered if you could do anything with that statement. Tell me it's false, I hope. Or how do they know that?
It's a bunch of words. It's a bunch of words and thoughts. They don't know that.
Mm-hmm, good.
You know, it's a diagnosis. With Dr. Michael Rice talk about that. He says, dia is two, and gnosis is knowing or not knowing, and so it's two who don't know. I mean, I can tell you that I've lost count of how many people I've had in my caseload who come in and they've got the diagnosis of bipolar and or schizophrenia, and they're on all these medications. And, of course, when you get the diagnosis of bipolar or schizophrenia, what you're told is, this is the truth, this is who you are, it will never change, this is a lifelong thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've lost track of how many people I've done therapy with who've had that diagnosis, either of those diagnoses, and have been on all kinds of medications. And when they're doing the right kind of therapy work, it isn't too long before they're not on any medications and or they're on many fewer medications, and they've got none of the symptoms that would lead someone to give them that diagnosis. And remember, the diagnosis is simply a checklist of symptoms that are either observed and or self-reported. That's all it is. It's
mm-hmm.
a label. It's nothing. You know, it's not like you can look at a bone and it's whole and complete, and you look at another bone and it's got a fracture in it. There is nothing that concrete about any of these labels. Yeah, there are some people who have lived lives that just seemed to get worse and worse and progressively worse over time, et cetera. And maybe even some of those who have had access to the really good effective therapies, et cetera. But the fact of the matter is, it's just words. It's not a thing. This is not, you know, and if there were a science behind it, the science would be there to disprove it. Because as I'm saying, you know, if the founder of, one of the four founders of the Journey's Dream got the diagnosis of bipolar, had, I don't know how many, 8 or 9 hospitalizations, had all kinds of drugs that he was on, and they said, this is it, you got to stay on these drugs the rest of your life. Well, he knew better, and he found treatments that were effective, and he no longer has any of the symptoms, and he's not taking any of those medications.
Oh, what a great story. I want to be able to tell that to Jacob, because he just does not want to be that. He wants to be well. It's great to see that. But, man,
well,
that would be wonderful.
I just did an interview with Dr. Ronald Bassman, and he got the diagnosis of schizophrenia because he had one psychotic episode when he was in his 20s. And not only did he get that diagnosis, they locked him in a hospital and they gave him like 40 different insulin coma treatments. It's a wonder they didn't permanently damage his brain beyond his ability to function at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got out, slowly recovered from what they were calling the treatments, the physical abuse that went on. And then he got a little racy in his thoughts again, and they put him in the hospital again. This time they loaded him up on different meds, and he got out. He got some good help. He got his doctorate. He became a psychologist. He's been working in the field for years, decades now. And he's an advocate for patient rights.
Mm.
There are all kinds of people that we've been meeting for the past almost 2 years through the Journey's Dream On Your Mind podcast who have had lived experience with mental health challenges, with intrusive psychiatric and psychological interventions, and all kinds of people who've gone through it and come out on top and learned that there are many other things you can do other than stay in therapy for the rest of your life and take these mind-numbing drugs, et cetera.
Mm.
That's one of the big reasons that we're doing almost every week for, it'll be 2 years this next February, interviews with people, either those who've been through and they were consumers of mental health services, or they're psychiatrists, integrative psychiatrists, functional medicine psychiatrists, or both. There are several people the one woman, Dr. Leela Masumi, is an integrative psychiatrist, and she said in the interview, I have been on almost every medication I ever prescribed to a patient.
Wow.
So she's had firsthand lived experience, and she knows how counterproductive it can be to just be thrown on a medication and told that this is your life and you're on this path to no life at all. So there are just a host of stories like that in the On Your Mind podcast archives. So it's not just one or two stories. It's an entire, there's an entire world out there of people who've had lived experiences and come through it. And the label is not the thing, and the person is not the label.
Well, he wants that kind of hope. That's good. I could even have him listen to this little part of the podcast, the radio show. Yeah, that's very encouraging to hear. He's also frightened because he has heard that having used LSD and mushrooms and nicotine and weed and what was it else? Something else. He's been on a lot of stuff, and he went off everything totally cold turkey without any supervision and became extremely sick, and that's what put him in the hospital and got him to us and got him from there into this program. I think what his body and mind went through during about 5 weeks of extreme detox stress without any help. Now he's afraid that he's hurt his voice and he's hurt his memory. He's hurt his short and long-term memory, and he's hurt his mind in general permanently. And he talks like that. I'm afraid I hurt myself totally and forever. He's 21. I'd love to also be able to say the brain regenerates. You're going to be fine. You're just going to stay off those things forever. And he feels committed to do that. Turned in his medical marijuana card, actually got an agreement from the company that if he should show up with his driver's license wanting to get weed, he would be refused. He did that. an amazing kid. But this is a sort of like living with a diagnosis. He keeps diagnosing himself as having ruined himself. And
well, just hold the space for him that he can learn differently. And he's young, and the more they do research on the brain, the more they learn about neuroplasticity, which means, among other things, the brain's ability to heal itself, the brain's ability to learn new things, the brain's ability to restructure itself to compensate for physical damage, etc. And just hold the space that he's going to grow into that, and just make sure that you minimize the amount of time you spend in that upset with him.
Right.
Just refuse to participate in the anxiety, angst-ridden energy, because, you know, if it's a negative thought about myself or somebody else, or a negative emotion active in my mind, I can instantly know it's false. It's not about the present moment. It's an old tape playing. And if I act from it or spend a lot of time pouring my mind energy into it, I'm just going to make my current situation worse. I can't help myself or anybody else if I'm stuck pouring my mind energy into thoughts that generate negative emotions.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm letting you know them, but I've been good, Dr. Tim. The tools have helped me just stay totally steady and upbeat, seeing Jacob as healed, well, good, wonderful company, and he's every day he seems better. So thanks for listening to The Downside. I've been keeping it quarantined from him. Yeah.
Yeah, think of your mind energy as a very powerful creative force. And you are, this is one of the things Michael Rice says in some of his early lectures, he would say it a lot, you know, like the biggest tragedy of our lives is that we've had hidden from us the fact that we are creators and that we are actively creating our experience of life. So think about that. Remind yourself of that. What are you feeling in this moment? If it's any negative emotion, take a breath, turn the focus inside and ask yourself, okay, how am I creating this negative emotion? Just the more I do that, the more I interrupt the pattern of pouring my mind energy into the negative emotions or the thoughts that create the negative emotions, and the less time I spend in negative emotions in my life. It's a huge boon to my quality of life, just that tool. Scanning, staying aware of the earliest warning signs that I'm in a negative emotional state, and taking that breath and asking myself, okay, how am I creating this? Alternatively, I ask myself, what am I making this situation mean? That it seems like a good thing to generate this negative emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And with that simple tool alone and my willingness to apply it, I've created a life where I spend the tiniest fraction of my life in negative emotional states compared to what I did before I began that practice.
Right.
Just waking up to the fact that you are a creator of your life experience, that where you focus your mind energy is a powerful creative force. If you find yourself spinning in negativity, you're creating that experience for yourself. If you have had some experience with energies like gratitude and compassion and appreciation and cherishing, and if you've had some experience with that, in the moment where you recognize that you're pouring your mind energy into something that generates a negative emotion, you can make the shift in that next moment. Shifting your thoughts and begin creating the experience of the better, happier, more compassionate, more joyful, more strong, more safe emotion. That's one of the core teachings in this work, to help us wake up, to observe it directly and wake up to the fact that we are creating our experience of life in each moment. And we're doing it by what we're choosing to focus our conscious awareness upon. And just right there, just wake up to how different that is than when you first started tuning into this work. You were convinced of the exact opposite, that the more time you spent in the negative emotional energy of worry, the better your life would go, the better your son's life would go, his plane would stay in
That's
the air,
so
et cetera.
That is so true. It's been a
And the only thing that
sure.
ever did, yeah, the only thing that ever did was give you more time to be in the misery. So to whatever degree you can, try to help yourself remember you're a creator. You're creating your life experience in each moment. You're not necessarily creating all the external events that come at you and move around you in your life, and yet you are definitely in each new present moment creating your experience of that flow of life energy. And it works. These tools are powerful. We had another example last night. Somebody on the internet, not in the internet show, but on the support group, called in and was facing some rather stuck feelings about a family member and some family drama that had evolved over the holiday and weeks leading up to the holiday. And in one worksheet, you know, at the beginning when we were starting to talk about it, before she got to one in the worksheet, her upset level was a 9 out of 10.
Wow.
And at the end of the worksheet, it was down to a level 1. And she started with, you know, anger and righteous indignation, and at the end, the primary emotion was sadness. But her upset level was down to a 1.
Wonderful.
And she had insight into a series of other worksheets she could do to continue to dismantle it even more. That's the power of this set of tools, and there's no figuring it out. There's just applying the tool. There's nothing I could have told her prior to that worksheet about where it was going to go and what it would lead to in her life. I don't even know this woman, right? I didn't know her growing up. I don't know anything of her family drama and history. All of that unfolds when she cancels what her mind tells her she needs to have happen and asks to be shown. And it was, you know, just another wonderful example of the power of this tool.
So, Dr. Tim, once we're doing the work, what I found, and maybe this has always been true, but I'm very aware of it now, is, for instance, in the middle of the night, I'll wake up and my mind will be crowded with regrets and remembering something that I did that was stupid. And I know this is very common, but once we're doing the work, are we kind of opening the way to remember things in order to resolve them and get them worked on? It's like the opposite of suppression. Everything feels invited to show up now.
It can be, yes. Some people experience that. And especially when they've gained facility with the tools, they welcome that.
Okay. I'm not
worried. Right,
because
I know I can clear this out. Yeah. Yeah, when it's been hiding and I haven't been able to deal with it when it's in hiding, And now it's out in the open. Mm-hmm. I welcome it.
And maybe that's part of the aging process, too. I had an aunt years ago. We watched out for her. She didn't have children of her own. And we watched out for her toward the end of her life. And what she was doing is remembering more and more some painful things that happened to her in her childhood, trying to realize, figure out, or whatever, trying to understand why certain things went the way they did. Now, during her life, she was very engaged, and I don't think that sort of thing was bothering her. I wonder if it's part of the aging process itself. In the Hindu tradition, they say that toward the end of your life, you may feel a lot of anguish over earlier events and thoughts and things you did. And they call that prarabdha karma, especially in the soul of a very high soul. The person is actually burning off the last of the dross before they are purified enough to go into heaven. It's a lovely idea. It's a lovely idea, too.
It's a fun story.
Yeah. Isn't it great?
Yeah, lovely
I love
idea.
It.
It's
Don't
a fun
tell me
story,
it's
yeah. I have no idea it's true. You'll have no idea it's true. The only way you'll know if it's true or not is if you live into it.
Well, it certainly makes the having of the bad memories have a happier purpose. Yeah, it's a story, but a useful one, maybe. Like, I'm having this. This is a blessing. Yeah. I get to be finished with it so I can go clean into heaven.
But the other thing that makes it easier or a blessing or whatever is to recognize it's just energy. It's just a memory. It's just a thought. The thought is not the thing. Mm-hmm. I am not my thoughts. I don't
need to be traumatized
by them any more than I'm traumatized by a 2-mile-an-hour wind that comes by when I'm on a walk in the spring or in the fall. Right? That the impact of those thoughts only has the impact on me that I give them. They only have the meaning for me that I give them. That's even more beneficial than buying into that whole story about a certain type of karma.
It's great, actually, and I've heard you say that many times, but you picked the right time to say it again. It went in the gray matter, I think, for the first time, maybe. Thanks.
You are very welcome and deserving. And we're down to our last couple minutes before I'm supposed to start a best of show for Michael and Jeannie. So thank you once again for your comments and questions and calls and helping us move through the hour in what I hope is beneficial for everyone involved. I will mute you so we can do the transition, but thanks again for the call. I will remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff we call love. We actually are the energy of love, extending in form, and everything else is false. And here comes a healing through relationships first hour of one of Michael Rice's signature seminars. Blessings.
Welcome to the workshop Healing Through Relationships. This workshop was originally called Healing Your Relationships because I used to think there was such a thing as a diseased relationship, and all you had to do was heal the relationship. What I came to discover in the years of doing this work is that every relationship is a perfect creation. There are no diseased relationships. Every relationship will perfectly reflect to you exactly what you need to deal with in your life. And through your relationship interactions, you get to look at the parts of you that hold you out of life. And as you do that and through those relationship interactions, you take responsibility and do your work, then through those relationships, you get to heal. Now, in one of our earlier workshops, we asked a question, and the question we asked was, how many have ever held a newborn? And we ask people to go back and imagine holding that newborn again and tap into the energy of the newborn. And we created a list out of people's responses to that question. And the list that we came up with was love, awesome, purity, peace, sweetness, inner sense, joy, wonder, and angelic. These are the words that people describe the newborn as. And of course, if you think about, if you're watching this tape right now or you're new to this workshop tonight, if you think about your experience of handling a newborn, you might have some different words to add to that. And I've asked this question about the newborn of tens of thousands of people, and 100% of the time people's answer is always some variation on the theme of love. And my offering is that that reason for that is because we each know exactly what it is that we're made of. We're made of this stuff called love. In fact, it is our very being. And when we give up the active presence of love in our lives, we are actually giving up life itself. Those words on the left-hand side of the board describe your true nature. They describe my true nature. They describe the true nature of every human being in existence. Although perhaps we found at times we or others don't exactly live up to that. In fact, the world teaches us to identify with something else. And so in an earlier workshop, I asked another question, and that was, how many have ever done something that they regret having done? And I asked people to go back and identify what they were feeling when they did what they regretted. And the list ended up being this list: guilt, shame, anger, fear, irritation, stupidity, pride, and worn out. And I point out that all of these words are words about non-being. When we go into the advanced course on relationship called codependence to interdependence, we'll see exactly how this non-being is formed and exactly what to do to undo it. The average person, in terms of their being in our culture, is dead, I would offer, by the age of 4. It takes another 70 or 80 years for their bodies to fall over because they've bought into an identity that is unlike what they really are. And when we buy into an identity that is unlike what we are, we're buying into death. We're giving up the very life force that keeps us vital. And that is why people think in terms of aging and death as a natural process. About 30 years ago, I was probably 9 or 10 years into this work when I heard a quote that came from a medical research group in Cincinnati, Ohio. It was a group called the DeCourcy Clinic. And I only heard this quote once, and it was so burned into my mind, I have never forgotten it. And here's what they said, medical researchers, mind you. And what they said was, time is not toxic. Time has no effect on human tissue under any conditions. It is the belief in the effect of time by those who subscribe to such a belief that acts as a poison. Aging is not natural, but if you put hostility or fear into your cellular structure, you will begin its deterioration. I was in New York doing a television interview a couple of years ago, several years ago now. And after I completed the interview, the fellow who was doing the interviewing said, you know, you're doing the same work as this cell biologist, Bruce Lipton. And I said, I'm doing the same work as a cell biologist. How do you figure that one? He said, well, watch his video. He gave me a copy of it. I watched it, and I was just amazed as I watched what this cell biologist is doing. Now, I've been teaching this work for going on to close to 40 years now. And here's what the latest in medical research is showing. When you think a thought, that thought turns into a molecule in your body. That molecule, which is called a neuropeptide, circulates around in your structure until it finds a cell with a receptor site that matches. And then the cell that it lands on replicates the neuropeptide chemically, and you get to live with the chemistry of your thoughts. Now, if you've ever found yourself in any of these states of non-being, guilt, shame, anger, fear, irritation, stupidity, pride, worn out, your mind says, well, I only feel those things because other people do things. They make me angry. They frighten me. They just wear me down. And I would offer that whatever excuse your mind uses to justify that somebody else is responsible for your hostility and fear, there has only ever been, there will only ever be one reason that you will ever in your life experience hostility and fear. And the reason will be because it is in your physiology. If it is not in your physiology, then you can't experience it. And when someone comes along and triggers it in you, an interesting thing happens in this human mind. We take what it is that we don't want to be responsible for. We've been through it 1,000 times, but we've always got somebody else to blame for it when it comes up in us. You made me angry. You made me afraid. You made me sad. You made me this. You made me that. And there is no "you made me" that is true. You only ever experience those energies because they are in your own physiology. Now, it's amazing how many people go into relationships carrying a ton of internal grief and trauma, and they go into the relationship expecting to find wonderment and peace. They find a shine in that relationship, and they think that shine will get rid of all their drama and trauma. And they're incorrect. Your relationships will never get rid of your drama and trauma. Only you can do that. In fact, as your relationships become more and more connected, if you're developing true relationships, they will show you more and more of the trauma that you hold in you. Because I would offer that before we as human beings put energies in that didn't belong in this body, you know, in the ancient teachings, the body was called a temple. And they talked about defiling the temple. Before you defiled your temple, the purpose of life I would offer was aliveness, joy, and creativity. You just have to watch a newborn to know that. But the world slowly creeps in, puts its thumbprints on you, and convinces you that hostility and fear is the way to go. And if you want to have true, real relationships, you can only have those when you open your heart. But if you've put trauma and drama, either genetically or from your own experiences, into your heart or your unconscious, then as you start to go into relationship and you open your heart, you'll find what's there. And you won't find what's there because of what your partner says or does, though they may be the one that triggers it in you at any given moment. You will only experience these energies because they're carried in your physiology, though your mind can make up 1,000 stories about how it's everybody else's fault. And so what we want to do with these tools is to recognize that true relationship happens when we can open our hearts, when we can be responsible for what we find there. And we turn to our relationships for the sacred support of assisting us in moving through the things that never belonged to us in the first place. Or we'll enter into relationship and we'll pretend that everything that we're feeling is caused by them. I would offer that the only things you can feel are the result of the energies and the information that you carry in you from your own life experience and from the experience of the generations. But the mind is tricky. The mind takes the content you don't want to own, and it builds pictures. And we think the pictures it builds are about what's out there. But the pictures it builds are not about what's out there. The pictures it builds always tell us about what's in here. And through our relationships, as we come to a level of connectedness and trust and open the next part of our heart and find what's there, instead of blaming everybody else for what's there in our relationships, when we take responsibility, we see in that situation the opportunity to heal. And so I'm going to do a piece of my art on the board. And, you know, if you've seen me do this before for the purpose of our camera and such, I'm going to ask you to just play along with us as we figure out what this piece of art is. And it's a fairly simple one. Can anybody tell me what it is that you see there on our board?
Kilroy.
No, it's not Kilroy.
A frog.
A frog. No, it's not a frog. What do you see?
Igloo.
A two-door igloo. No, not a two-door igloo. Come on, what is it?
A tunnel.
A tunnel. A car.
A Volkswagen.
A Volkswagen. Well, actually, it's a scrub woman from the back. Well, truly, it's just lines on a board. When you look at those lines on the board through your mind, you're looking at a framework. That framework causes content in your mind to fire. Now, the only way that content can fire is if it's in your mind, obviously. Let's imagine that we took a man from the jungles of South America. This fellow has never seen anything more complex than a dugout canoe. And we show him this diagram on the board. How long do you think it would take, and how much experience and how much explanation would you have to come up with to really truly get him to understand what you mean when you say this is a two-door igloo? What kind of content is going to have to be placed in his mind? I mean, to this fellow who's come from the Guatemalan jungles, it's subtropical. He's never been in a temperature where it's below 70 degrees. How much explaining are you going to have to do to him? What kind of content are you going to have to get into his mind for him to understand freezing cold? So cold that water that comes from the sky turns into white fluffy stuff. So cold that waves coming out of a body of water actually freeze in midair. What are you going to have to do to explain to him that you have a device with which you cut blocks of this hard water and you stack them and you form a home made out of frozen water? And you crawl inside of one of these two doors in order to stay warm. What are you going to have to give him in the way of content for him to have a clue what you're talking about? Do you get some sense of just something as simple as a two-door igloo, the complexity of content, the number of different files in the mind that have to fire to produce that reality of a two-door igloo? How long do you suppose it's going to take to get him to understand fully what you mean when you say a two-door igloo? Do you think you could explain it to him in 10 minutes? Do you think you're going to have to take him out on an icy cold day and show him what frozen water means, because they don't know about refrigerators? He's never seen this frozen water. He's never seen this white stuff come from the sky. He has no brain cells. He has no content for what you're talking about. Though you and I think in offhanded terms of two-door igloo. How are we able to do that? We are only able to do that because we have this complexity of content in our brain cell structure. And so when we look at that two-door igloo, we take the content of our minds and we project that content into our brain's image of the igloo. But is the igloo out there? That's just lines on a board. Where is the igloo in this experience? It's strictly in the brain cells of the person who's looking at the framework. Now, once you recognize that, you have a deep insight into relationships. Because, you know, when you look at somebody and you have a classification for them that holds a lot of complexity about their, you know, what kind of things might be issues in relationships. They're cold, they're hard-hearted, they're angry, they're manipulative, they pick on me, and on and on and on and on and on. In order to have that kind of complex reality show up in your mind about another person, do you suppose that perhaps that other person is just a framework that resonates content in you that you then put into your brain's image of them? And you might remember in Romans 2, and if you go back into the ancient Aramaic teachings, those teachings were simply about how life works, how our human organism works, how our minds work, how the health process of this human physiological system works, and how the world works. You might remember in Romans 2, they said, "Beware you who judge another, for that in which you judge another, you have been guilty of practicing." You know, I only need to listen to your conversation for 2 minutes about somebody that you're upset with, and I know a lot about the content of your mind. And you may not know that you're telling your life story as you spill about somebody else, or what you think is somebody else. And when you go into interaction with someone, what happens is that your content, where you are able to open and allow yourself to look at it, comes forward, but the mind does an interesting trick. It takes your content and it makes it look like it's about somebody else. So when we have a conflicting situation in a relationship, here's what we have. We have person one with problem one. Problem one comes from the mind of person one and is the content of person one, but it is projected into the brain's image of person two. So person one is sure that person two is responsible for their content. And they lie to themselves because they have no clue that what they're feeling is what's happening inside of them. Now, that makes for complexity in relationship, because here's what happens. Person two, we're going to move them over here a little bit. Person two also has content. And when person one starts to resonate the painful content of person two, out of the content in their minds, they will create an image of person two. And they'll be sure the person two who has problem two will be sure that it's caused by person one. And they will assign the task of making sure that person one cleans up the content of their minds, while person one assigns the task of cleaning up the content of their mind to person two. Have you ever wondered why relationships can get so crazy? Because you're always looking at and feeling the content of your own mind. Everything that shows up as an image in your mind comes from what you hold in your mind. But if you pretend that it's not yours, then you will create a condition called unconscious, or what in the ancient scriptures was called the heart. And you might remember that this man named Yeshua 2,000 years ago said, you must forgive from your heart the wrongs of your brother. Now, through the Greek translations of those teachings, at least as it was always presented to me, I was supposed to let this terrible person who was the cause of all my pain off the hook for the fact that in this relationship I had pain. So this bleeding heart, I would forgive from my heart these terrible things that my brother did to cause all of my pain. And then everything would get better. If I do that form of so-called forgiveness, which incidentally is not forgiveness at all, what have I done? Have I done anything to address and heal the content of my own mind? I have done nothing to do that. In fact, by forgiving them, I have intensified the energy of my own painful content. Now, there is a benefit to pardoning, and what we've been taught in this culture is a tool of pardoning in place of forgiveness. We've been taught, you're responsible for my content, but I'll let you off the hook. Now, that usually comes from a place of some connectedness with love. And what we know is that when there is connectedness with love, whatever we can get to come out of the heart or the unconscious will begin to heal. So when we can lovingly let somebody else off the hook, whatever it is that will surface in our minds that is painful content will start to dissolve. Not because we've let them off the hook, but because there is the active presence of love when our painful content comes forward. But at the same time as I do that, by assessing or judging that my brother did this terrible thing, I just reinforce the energy dynamics of my own painful content, which means I'm going to get to do more and more and more of it. Now, what Yeshua would say in Aramaic would not be, you must forgive, let your brother off the hook for your painful content. What Yeshua would say to you is, you've got to stop your denial. You've got to stop pretending that your content is about anybody but you. And you must go into, and that word heart, you know, we could not translate the word heart from the Aramaic in the Western world until just a few decades ago. For almost 2,000 years, we have been ignorant of the meaning of that word. The Aramaic language is a language that is rife with idioms, and the whole thought structure and understanding of the teachings out of that Aramaic language can only be understood in getting the original context and meaning of that language. My assessment in 25 years, I'm the director of a foundation that's translating the oldest known copy of the New Testament in Aramaic into English, and my assessment of that process in that coming from the Greek language is that you cannot speak the actual teachings of Yeshua in the Greek context. expecting the Greek level of understanding and language, because language reflects the experience of a culture, expecting that language to carry the meanings that Yeshua had for his words is like expecting a kindergarten class to be able to give you a dissertation in nuclear physics. They're not going to be able to do it. It's just not possible. And so when you go back to the Aramaic, what you hear Yeshua saying in his original context, or, well, let me give you an example. Let's imagine that one of you here is an expert at speaking Russian. I don't speak any Russian. But we have someone who's going to fly over for our workshop series from Russia. And you volunteer to pick him up at the airport. You're going to put him up for the week, and you're going to house him and shuffle him around, and you're going to act as his translator. Now, let's imagine that through the period of the week, we get together and we have a couple of lunches. We maybe go catch a movie. We have dinner together a couple of times. This guy comes to all the workshops. We really have a great time, a rollicking time with this fellow. And at the end of the week, as you're getting ready to take him back to the airport, I ask you if you would let our friend know that I think that he is really cool. And you turn to him in your best Russian and explain to him that I think he's got a low body temperature. Now, you translated my words perfectly, right? But did you convey anything of what I meant to him? Nothing whatsoever. The Greek language is so inept at being able to carry the flower, the subtleties of that Aramaic teaching, that it's lost. And what we know now is, since the unconscious has been rediscovered in the West, is that when they said you must forgive from your heart, what they were saying is you must remove from your unconscious, from the part of you that you've been hiding in your brain's image of everyone else, that which you've put into your brain's image of your brother. So in essence, he was saying you get to heal through your relationships. You will get to interact with your brother. Your brother's going to do a behavior that's going to show you your content. If your content is about non-being and that content takes over your awareness, then it will rob you of life itself. But you will say, and my brother really made me angry, or my brother really made me sad, or my brother really made me afraid. And you know, when people do that, they go, why does my brother leave me? Why am I left alone in relationships? What's going on here? Well, one of the things that most people do when they're about this size is they watch the adults around them when those adults are in pain. Have you ever watched a 2 or 3 year old see mom or dad in tears and go over and try to calm them and make them feel better and fix it for them? Anybody ever seen that happen? Now, what did the 2 or 3 year old child discover when they tried to do that? They discovered that they couldn't fix it for mom or dad. And almost everyone has created content or files in their minds that say that I can't fix mom or dad, therefore it is my fault. In about 100% of the situations where I've worked with people from divorced homes, and I don't care if they're people who are 50 or 80 years of age or 10 years of age, they believe that their parents' divorce was their fault. Why? Because when they didn't know any better, at 2 or 3, they tried to fix it and they couldn't do it. And then came to the conclusion that it was their fault. So they have a file in their mind, so to speak, on my fault. And then, having tried perhaps more than once to fix it for an ailing parent, they went, it's hopeless. And they formed a file on hopelessness. And they formed further a file on, I can't do anything here, I'm helpless. Now, people, generally speaking, aren't in touch enough with their unconscious dynamics to know that when they're blamed for what someone else is experiencing, that they are being blamed by their own minds. And that when this person they're in relationship says, you made me angry, what this person is in essence saying is, I, person one, have problem one called anger. It's my content, and it's all your fault, and I expect you to fix it for me. What's the response of most people when somebody simply uses a phrase of, you made me angry, sad, afraid? What that resonates in this person is, uh-oh, it's my fault, it's hopeless, and I'm helpless, and they leave. Now, many people physically stay present in that relationship, but they disappear. They leave emotionally. I've seen people who've had relationships where they've been together, or so-called relationships, where they've been together for decades, but there's been no relationship for decades because they emotionally left way back here. If you want to actually create relationships where people feel like staying long-term, you can't use projection language. Projection language is, you made me sad, you made me afraid, you made me angry, you made me, you made me, you made me. Tomorrow night's workshop, we're going to do communication, the early workshop, communication, did you hear what I think I said? And we're going to distinguish between what we call projection language and responsibility language. And how to start to language in a way that rather than bringing up this hopeless, helpless, it's my fault, you can help people to clear those energies out of their field, out of their file structure, and through your interaction, especially where there's conflict, you create healing because you've got the tools with which to create healing. And the opportunity to heal generally comes embodied in the form of a conflict in relationship, because we will draw people to us through an energetic principle called the law of resonance. And the law of resonance, simply stated, says that when two energy systems are in tune or in harmony with each other, there's an interaction between them. There's a transfer of energy. It's called resonance. And so what will tend to happen is, according to the content of person two's mind, they will set up a field. And this is a literal, measurable energy field. Person one, according to their content, will set up a field. If there is a resonance between them, these two will be attracted to each other. All too often, people's attraction is based upon their matching bags of garbage. How do you tell? And by the world, in the world, relationships based in matching bags of garbage are called love relationships, interestingly enough. How do you tell if you've got an actual love relationship or a relationship based in matching bags of garbage? It's very easy. Have you ever had a relationship where love has turned to hate? Anybody ever had one of those? Well, my offering to you is that is absolutely impossible. Love, being, can only ever be itself. That's all it can ever be. And any relationship or any part of relationship that's based in being will always remain exactly that. But relationships through resonance and matching bags of garbage can turn to hate in just one instant. How does that happen? It happens when a person takes their content and they utilize this other person to keep their content hidden from themselves, and they insist that this other person must follow a set of rules so they never have to look at their content. And the minute that this person stops behaving in a way that keeps this person from looking at their own content is when love turns to hate. And they'll take their whole bag of garbage and dump it on their partner. But they dump it on their partner because it is in their mind to dump it. Now, how do you tell whose mind this garbage belongs to? We have this really complex test that we've developed in this work. It takes some time to learn it, but it's very powerful once you take the time to learn this tool. And the way you tell if the trauma or pain is from your content or not is, are you feeling it? If you're feeling it, you're feeling it because it is in your field. Just because you can successfully build your brain's image of someone else out of it does not mean it belongs to that someone else. But people who live in denial and hold generations of painful content don't believe that their content's got anything to do with them. They'll talk about love and light, but when the chips are down and the stress is up, they'll take their painful content and put it into their brain's image of someone else, and they'll insist that they must be irritated, angry, frustrated, sad, or afraid because of what their partner did. And guess what? You can only be irritated, angry, sad, or afraid because your mind holds energies of non-being. And the truth is that this person has come to relationship with you carrying the blessing of knowing how to resonate what it is that you need to heal. If you stop projecting and pretending that your content belongs to them and you start owning your content, then you can start through your relationships to heal. Now we have a worksheet that we're going to hand you now. And what we're going to do is we're going to ask you to think about your three earliest memories of conflict. So the first step we're going to ask you to do, and if you're watching this on the video and you don't have the worksheet, you can go to our website, which is www.whyagain.com, whyagain.com, and look under worksheets, and you'll find the worksheet for this workshop. And it's called the Healing Through Relationships worksheet. And so the first thing we're going to ask you to do is to look at the three numbers, number one, number two, and number three. And we're going to ask you to write about your three earliest memories of conflict. Now, there's some other material in between, but let that other material go for now. Write the three early memories of conflict first. Now, what is a memory of conflict? That is something that you classify as conflict. You don't need my definition. It can be a conflict in which you were directly involved, or it can be a conflict in which you were just an observer. It doesn't matter. Whatever your mind defines as conflict, this is your worksheet. It's only for your use. And so start out, if you would, and the three early memories of conflict. And as you write those, are you breathing? Does anybody notice anything happening with your breath? What did you notice? You stopped. You're holding your breath. Now, when I don't want to own my content and I want to project it, in order to do that, I have to hold my breath. I have to shut down the flow of the breath so I can take this information that I'm hiding from myself and use it to build my brain's image of someone else. So what we're going to ask you to do as you write is to let yourself breathe. Let yourself keep your breath moving. Keep observing your breath and keep your breath moving as you write about your three earliest memories of conflict. Once you've finished with the three early memories, then what we're going to ask you to do is to fill in a set of blanks for each of those memories. And a set of blanks, if you take a look, looks like life is, I am, I feel. People are, relationships are, I must, I need, I want to punish whoever's involved by or myself by. And so that would be one set of blanks for memory one, another set of blanks for memory two, another set of blanks for memory three. Now, what might the answers look like? Well, let's imagine we've got a young man who has been just knocked off his bicycle by his brother. And his brother has beat him up. He's laying there with a bloody nose. And I walk up with a tape recorder. Gee, Sonny, how do you feel about life? Oh, life hurts. Life sucks. And how about yourself? I'm weak and helpless. And relationships, they're the pits. And on and on goes his list. So that would be one set of blanks. We're going to ask you to fill in one set of blanks for each of the three memories. And we're going to take an intermission. So we had a couple of questions in our intermission about this worksheet. And first of all, The place where you put in that memory of conflict can be, again, a situation where you were directly involved or you were just observing someone in conflict. It doesn't matter. Whatever your mind defines as conflict. And then we had some questions about the punishment part. Well, who would want to punish themselves? Anyone in hostility or fear can turn the punishment that they hold toward themselves. And the reason for that is because the mind is using corrupt data, and when we're in hostility and fear, we're insane. We're functioning out of a mind. And the definition I use for insanity in this work is a mind without love is a mind that's insane. Why would we take someone who we say, you are so dear to my heart, I love you, I cherish you, and why would we do some of the things that we've done to them? In fact, we live in a culture that has songs whose title go or whose melody line goes, you only hurt the one you love. Who would do that? Why would anybody do that? One who would do that would be someone who does not have love for their partner, but rather has matching bags of garbage for their partner. And when they lose the presence of being, the mind will do anything that it's been structured to do. In fact, we have generations of that kind of stuff going on inside of us. You know, how many remember the story about Moses in the desert wandering for 40 years? Do you remember what had to happen before they could get out of the desert and go into the promised land? Now, I'd offer that word desert as a code word, again, for the unconscious. It was about we human beings who wander around wondering what end is up and why is this happening to me again. When they said the old generation had to die off, that did not mean that everybody in old physical bodies had to physically die. The root of the word generation is genari, which means cause. All of the old causes held in the mind had to be removed. And literally, when you recognize that this body-mind unit is an energy system, it is a device that stores every frequency that comes to it. Every thought, every feeling, every reality is stored holographically in every cell, including the sperm and the egg. And were you to conceive a child tomorrow, that child would have in its structure every thought you've ever thought, every feeling you've ever felt, every reality you have ever engaged in. It's all stored there. And when a child is conceived, that child is conceived and has in the single cell at conception every thought, every feeling, every reality of the previous generation. In fact, in the Aramaic, where they understood how this worked, they said the sins of the father, and of course it's not just the sins, the wonderful things are there too, of the previous generations are stored holographically within the structure. And what they said in the Aramaic was, four generations. The old generation had to die off. That is, the impact of those old energies had to be removed from your body-mind unit. Elsewise, what your body-mind unit would tend to do would to be to unfold the dynamics of the generations. There's a wonderful system of family therapy. And in family therapy, one of what I consider to be one of the most powerful assignments that's often given is you interview everybody that's ever known anything about anybody in your family. If there's a woman in the village that your great-grandfather was raised and she was 6 years old when he was 102 and she's now 96, you go talk to her and find out what she knew. And what happens as people write the history of these generations is all of a sudden they see an assembly of all of what they thought were the choices they had made in their lives. And they had made no original choices. This genetic structure that we have is a vibratory database that carries information from the generations. So when they said the sins of the father would be passed down to three and four generations, that wasn't about punishing you for what your fathers and their fathers and all the way back to Adam did. It was just telling you how this energy system works, that you've got that data in there. And of course, when you go back to the fourth generation back, where did they get their thoughts, feelings, and realities? But from the previous four. Who got them from the previous four? You have your whole bloodline in your structure and the patterns that go along with it. If you have any doubt about that, go out and check out a couple of the books that have been written about identical twins who are separated at birth and don't even know that the other one exists. And look at how many so-called choices they made that were identical to the twin that they lost contact with at birth. Here they are 50 years later, and there's so many things in their lives that are identical because we are energetic frequency beings. And we tend, unless we're awake to our being, which is what our relationships give us the opportunity to do, we tend to simply play out the thoughts of the generations. Jeannie went to the computer when we talked about this, and she did some spreadsheets on how many lives there are in a number of generations. Now, when you take four generations, what you have is 31 lives. When you take yourself, mom and dad, mom and dad's mom, if we go back four generations, that's 31 lives. Now, just for interest's sake, when you start recognizing those patterned ways of thinking, are there 10 generations, there are 2,047 people in your bloodline in 10 generations. That means, and just think about your life experiences and your thoughts and your feelings about what's happened around conflicts and situations and the world situations and family situations. Think about what's happening two generations ago, four generations ago. Go back 10 generations and recognize that the thoughts and the feelings and the patterns of those 10 generations are passed to you at conception. That's 2,047 lives. If you go to 20 generations, we're now talking in your bloodline about 2,097,152 people. 20 generations. If we go back 50 generations, and we're talking about how these patterns develop, we're looking at 2,252 with 12 zeros after it. That's how many people are in your bloodline. If you go back 120 generations, you've got 2,658 with 33 zeros behind it. These are patterned ways of thinking and feeling that came in with your physiological energy system. And just for interest's sake, because the number's kind of fun, the spreadsheet would only go up to, where you could read the zeros, would only go up to 800 generations. You know how many there are? There are 1,333 people, and then there are 243 zeros behind that in 800 generations of your bloodline. Now, when you start to look for patterns and you start to clean the patterns up, everything changes. Now, what I'm going to ask you to do is to look at your worksheet with your three early memories. And under the blank life is, the first blank, I'm going to ask you to look at memory one, memory two, and memory three. Does anybody notice anything? They're similar? How many notice that they're similar or the same? I see a number of heads shaking unenthusiastically, yes. If you look at I am under memory one, memory two, memory three, do you see a pattern? Are there any similarities? I feel, people are, relationships are. Look at the patterns in those three early memories. And now, if you would, imagine yourself or recall yourself in a conflict with someone that you had, let's say, within the last week. If you were to look at a conflict situation at some time in the last week and quickly fill out a set of blanks, would there be a similarity in the pattern when you look at that conflict in the last week and what happened in your early memories? Mm-hmm. Most people going yes? Yes, yes. Okay. Now, if you look at the pattern in the early memories, and you look at that conflict today, how many thought when you dealt with that conflict today in the last week that you were actually dealing with the conflict of an adult? And guess what? Most of us are continuously dealing with content that we made up as children, and we're still projecting it into our brain's image of others and thinking it's about others. If you went back and looked at, or, well, let's do another step there. If you look, let's let go of the responsibility aspect that we're talking about with this work for a moment, and let's go with the world's way of looking at things. It's all their fault. If you look at who did it to you in your early memories and you look at who did it to you today, is it the same person?
No.
No? Most people, it was somebody different. All right. Now, imagine yourself going back, let's say, well, 5 or 6 years ago. It's around 2000, 7 years ago. And you look at a conflict you had around the year 2000. If you sketched in a set of blanks, would the pattern be similar to your conflicts today and your early memories? Most heads disappointingly shaking yes. Okay. If you look at who did it to you in your early memories, and you look at who did it to you today, and you look at who did it to you in 2000, is it the same person? No? For most people, it's somebody different. All right? Now, let's go back 10 years ago. And 10 years ago, looking at those conflicts, let's look at a conflict situation that went on 10 years ago. And if you look at what happened in that conflict situation, so imagine we're going back to about 1995. You want to look at a situation that was a conflict at that point. If you look at the pattern, is the pattern similar to your early memories, your present conflict, and the one you had around 2000? Pattern similar? Is the pattern similar? I can't hear you.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, we got most of the yeses. All right. Now, if you look at who did it to you in your early memories, you look at who did it to you today, you look at who did it to you 5, 6, 7 years ago, and then you look at who did it to you 10 years ago, is it the same person? No. Somebody different. Okay. Let's go back 20 years ago. Think about a conflict that was happening in your life about 20 years ago. If you fill in a set of blanks, is the pattern similar?
Yes.
Yes, okay. And if you look at who did it to you 20 years ago, is it the same person that did it in your early memories, did it to you today, did it to you 5 years ago, did it to you 10 years ago? Is it the same person?
No.
No, somebody different. Okay. So now what I'm going to ask you to do is to raise your hand, kind of just your right hand over your shoulder a little bit, and if you would, pat yourself on the back for how much power you have, because that's a lot of power to pull that many people in over that long a period of time out of your content and to get them to keep doing those things to you. That's a lot of power. Now, I would offer that life is construction and delivery. And according to the content that you hold in your mind, life responds. You might remember this fellow 2,000 years ago that said, here's how life works, folks. If you ask, you receive. And that means if you've received it, it's because you've asked for it. Now, of course, most people go, well,
wait a minute. This isn't what I've been asking for. You haven't been reading my mail.
Oh, wait a minute. That's not what you've been asking for in your head. But remember in the ancient teachings where they understood how it really worked? They didn't say, as a man thinketh in his head, so will be his life. What did they say? As a man thinketh in his heart. As you think in your unconscious, when you say, This isn't what I've been asking for. This isn't what I want. Your wanter is not in your head. Your wanter's in your heart, and it works according to the accumulations of content, the accumulations of data from all the generations. And they literally set up a field, a measurable high-energy wave that sends out a signal that draws or resonates to you exactly the person who can deliver to you what it is that you're asking for. And you ask by the generational accumulations of energy. And you have a lot of power. Now, as long as you believe that when this person delivers to you a behavior, that the content of your mind, your hostility and fear, is caused by them, you cannot reach into your heart and remove from your heart the wrongs of your brother. Those things that you put into your brain's image of someone else, you think belongs to them, and of course you can't change them. Yeshua is really clear. You've got to look into your own heart. You've got to look into your content that you put into your brain's image of another, and you've got to acquire the skill of removing from your unconscious that which never belonged in a human being in the first place. If you don't ever do that, then you will tend to put an end to relationship after relationship after relationship. It is so important that if you really want to have conscious, fulfilling, wonderful relationships, that you own and clean up what's going on in your mind through the process of your relationships.